Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Booth 61. Featuring movers and shakers on the Atlanta tech scene, organizations serving the tech market, and the inspired people who lead them. Now here's your host, Ricky Steele.
Welcome and thank you for visiting Booth 61. I am Ricky Steele, and I passionately serve as the Chief Development Officer for Hunter Technical Resources, Atlanta's premier IT staffing firm. We have a very exciting show for you today, and we're going to jump right in. But first, I want to take a half a minute to introduce our producer and my good friend, Kevin Finn. Kevin is a master of the control board and makes me sound much better than I ever could possibly be without his help. How are you today, Kevin?
I'm doing good, Ricky. I think these are, I know you've had a lot of high-level guests in here, but these are some of my favorite guys that you think you've brought in so far. So,
my oldest son, Everett, said that, Dad, this is going to be your best show of all because he's excited about the content.
Definitely. Well, I mean, EVE Online is one of the most hardcore MMOs out there. And I have some of my favorite stories just from people doing stuff.
Well, you host a number of the shows here on Business Radio X, so at some point, if you want to jump in and ask a question,
I might just do that.
Jump in. We'd love to have you. And I also have with me my dear friend and co-worker at Hunter Technical Resources, Jess Jones, with us today. And Jess is going to be live tweeting at hashtag JJESSJJONES. She's Jess Jones with a lot of J's. That's JJESSJJONES, and Jess will be giving you an update, and you can read it along with her or go back and see them at your own pleasure. I'm very excited about our program because this is a subject I've wanted to know more about over the years. I have gamed a little in my day, but not anything to the degree of EVE or any of the other games that's part of CCP games. And I'm glad you're here listening to me, and hopefully you'll be with me and we'll listen and learn together. Today we have two experts in the field of online gaming with one of the most successful gaming companies in the industry, CCP Games. Bill Winter is the general counsel at CCP. Bill is an Emory graduate from right here in Atlanta, Georgia, and spent 11 years at Morris Manning & Martin, where he was a colleague with a previous guest on this show, many of you in the technology community know, Mr. John Yates. Bill and I are also former alumnus of PricewaterhouseCoopers and overlapped our times there together. Ned Coker is the senior PR specialist at CCP and has been with the firm and its predecessor in Atlanta, White Wolf, for over 5 years, which I would think in online gaming history must be two or three lifetimes. Ned also has something in common with John Yates, as both are Duke graduates, so a lot of commonality with John Yates, as it happens in Atlanta quite often. Welcome to Booth 61, Bill and Ned.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Well, I'm glad you're here, and I'm glad you're going to tell us all about the wonderful world of online gaming. I want to ask you a series of questions that I believe will help our audience better understand CCP games, the online gaming industry, and some of your more successful games. These questions can, of course, be answered by either one of you, both of you, or y'all can take turns dancing through the answers and ask each other follow-up questions if you so desire. But I've got a lot of questions that I think will be informative, certainly to help me understand the business better, and I think our guest as well. But to begin, the best way to know more about CCP Games is going to the website, which is www.ccpgames.com.
Yep.
That's right.
We want to repeat that a couple of times during the show, but www.ccpgames.com. I started our conversation with a brief introduction of both of you guys, but what I'd like to do now is maybe give you each a couple of minutes to share with the audience a little bit more about yourself, anything you want to share, any dark secrets, any things that I don't know how if the police scanner picks up this channel, but you may not have to go too deep, but anyway, and then maybe share with us how you first arrived at CCP Games. I'll start with Ned. You're to my immediate left.
Yeah, sure. So my dark secret is every day I wake up in the morning, I stare at myself in the mirror, and I cry a little bit. But then getting over it, you know, I sort of slap myself around a little bit, and I head into work. It's it's a wonderful place to work. So a little bit about me. I do PR and social media for CCP Games, mostly EVE Online, but some of our other products. I love gaming and passionate about gaming. I think, you know, it's a form of entertainment that gives you an immersion that other forms of entertainment are really struggling to kind of like bring to bear there. You know, whether it's movies becoming more interactive, having like fan clubs and stuff like that. Like in gaming, you can become part of the game itself and affect other people in really compelling ways. And so that's sort of what drives me at my job is knowing what gaming can bring to people, what it's brought to my own life. I think it's something that's underappreciated because of the way gaming came into the industry. But you know, apart from that, I love reading, photography, my wife, my 2-year-old son, and I would be remiss not to mention them.
So. Smart move. And how did you get to CCP? Was it through the acquisition of White Wolf?
Yeah. So I was a lowly marketing intern at White Wolf Publishing before they merged with the Viking mega corporation that is CCP. White Wolf is a role playing game company that's been making fantasy horror role-playing games, board games for over 20 years now. In 2006, they were looking for a company to make a massively multiplayer online game out of their property. At the same time, CCP, which made EVE Online, was looking to expand into role-playing games, board games, and card games. Figured out that they were kindred spirits, both in terms of game design decisions, but also in terms of the general sort of crazy Viking spirit that they have personally, and merged. And with that merger, I became part of CCP and just sort of worked my way up into the PR position that I'm in.
Great. Thank you very much. I like the word immersion, the opportunity to the two companies merge together. And with that immersion, you're now creating games that you mentioned earlier. Players can actually get immersed in on the entire action. So I really do like the way you formed that.
That's something that we'll be talking a lot about, I think, today. That's great, very great. Important.
Bill?
Yeah. I came from a little bit different path. As you mentioned, I was a lawyer, great technology firm, Morris, Manning & Martin, spent years there. But I was always a bit of a square peg in a round hole. I was the only attorney that had Lord of the Rings characters in his shelves rather than books. And for a while, I had a sword in the office. And, you know, there were just some things they didn't find sensible about me. But I remember right about the time that White Wolf was looking to do the deal with CCP, they were hunting for a good deal lawyer. And like any technology company, they found their way to John Yates. And John was getting ready for the meeting, and he came down to my office and said, "I think these might be your people. Will you go to this breakfast with me?" And so sat down and talked with him, and sure enough, within 5 minutes we found out. We had several common connections. I'd been to Gen Con and a bunch of the conventions that they go to, and so it was a match made in heaven. So I ended up doing the deal work, representing White Wolf in the merger, and I guess I didn't completely suck because they kept using me afterwards, and CCP eventually used me for a lot of their U.S. work. I'd always done a lot of international work, and one Sunday down at the Independent, which is a bar that one of the founders owned here in Atlanta, famous pool hall, we were having beers one Sunday and just talking, and he said, "You know, I got an idea for you." Next thing I knew, I was working here. So very fortunate, very lucky, and finally I'm no longer that square peg.
Well, you look like you fit into it well. You got your jeans going and your sport coat, so you got both worlds working hard.
I can go back and forth if need be.
He's still the best dressed person at our company.
Well, yeah, we took a company trip to Turkey not too long ago, and on the bus ride there, it was funny. One of the developers sitting next to me looked at me and goes, "Bill, what's it like to be respectable all the time? How do you actually do that?"
And the thing is, they don't know that you're just masking respectability most of the time.
But once you learn how to fake sincerity, everything else is easy.
It's right.
Yep. No question. All right, that's great, guys. Thank you. Now, tell me a little bit about CCP. I'm not that familiar with it. Of course, Kevin knows a great deal about it, and I think Jess and certainly my son Everett. The company's been around more than 15 years, and in Atlanta, I guess, since 2006 with the merger of White Wolf. Mm-hmm. Some of our listeners may not know the company, kind of like me. How did you guys get started, and what all does the company do?
Yeah, so it started out with a few guys in Iceland who were good friends, having the idea to create basically this massive universe of Starship pilots and really – kind of that was their grand vision. You know, they were inspired a lot by the feeling of Iceland a little bit. The countryside is cold. It's dark there. They have, you know, the northern lights that you can see from the city. There's lava landscapes. It's very like space-inspiring sort of thing. And I think there's a certain amount of like the Viking ethos that still resides in the resonance in the modern day there that that is like this intrepid exploration group. And so, you know, kind of against all odds, they had this dream and they got in their metaphorical longboats and sailed towards it.
Viking culture.
Yeah. Their first stop was to create a board game, basically to help raise money for the actual beginning of development there. And so they made this really interesting board game that was only in Icelandic at the time, in cooperation with Alcoholics Anonymous about like avoiding the dangers of using drugs and alcohol and stuff like that. But it had a cooperative multiplayer edge to it that exists a lot in EVE today. So they made that. They raised enough money. They gathered all the best tech minds in Iceland, which you know at the time kind of barely had a stable internet connection for more than a week going out of the country, and they just went for it. You know, they slept all kinds of nights in the office, and they just powered through, got a deal. Their vision became, you know, true, and they took it around to trade shows. People didn't believe the way that the game looked at first. They thought it was all photoshopped, and they just stuck with the vision, put it out in a relatively terrible state to begin with, but then kept at it, kept talking to the fans, and it's grown every year since. So,
you know, just to give you a size of scale for this game, I was struck recently, earlier this year, Iceland had their parliamentary election. It happened to be the same time that we were having a fan festival in Reykjavik, and we were having a player election. We'll talk more about it later, but we're having a player election. We actually had more people participating and voting in the player election in EVE than they had people voting in the parliamentary election in Iceland. It was.
I hate to show my stupidity, but how many people live in Iceland?
There's fewer than play EVE, so there's around 310,000 to 320,000 people, and so there's more than 500,000 people that play EVE.
Gracious,
yeah.
Gracious.
But to take a step back, because we didn't quite get to this, just. Like, what do we make? And I think it's important to just talk generally about what we make before we dive into the specifics of the game. So we make types of games that are called massively multiplayer online games. And that means that there are thousands of people from around the world connecting to the same game universe and having the same shared experience. There are other games out there that are massively multiplayer games. One of the most popular ones is World of Warcraft. They have tens of millions of people playing. But our game is different from that. First of all, it's sci-fi. So anything you can imagine doing as a spaceship pilot in a sci-fi universe, you can do in the game. But kind of most importantly, we make the type of game called sandbox games. And that means, you know, if you imagine you're as a kid and you're plopped down in a sandbox and your parents give you like a pail and, you know, a little bit of water and a rake. And then you just do what you want. You build your own castles. You might make a dragon or whatever you want. And that's the spirit of the type of game that we make. So we created this universe and sort of seeded it through all this cool like chaos theory fractal, you know, stuff that happened. But then the players came in and they can do whatever they want to in it.
Yeah, it's a big difference from most video games on the market, which we refer to EVE as a sandbox. Most other games we refer to as theme parks. So like you'd go to Six Flags and you go ride one, ride two, ride three. You know, when you play a Call of Duty or a Halo or something like that, you have a very guided, very scripted process that you follow, and you beat the level and you go to the next level and so on and so forth. EVE is a lot more challenging because it literally is an open world, and you know, part of the challenge is figuring out, what do I do next?
Yeah, and so there's, not to go too long into this, but there's a couple reasons why that works. One is, since the beginning of the game's launch, everybody's played on the same game server all the world around. Usually you'll divide up the population of a game into like multiple different copies of the same game world. So that means we have 500,000 people interacting in the same game universe over time, and then it has a rich 10-year history because it's persistent. And then the other aspect of it, too, is one of the main design philosophies of the company is that death is a serious matter. So when your ship gets blown up in the game, you don't like get a new ship. You don't go somewhere else. You're sitting there in your escape pod still vulnerable. So all of that stuff sort of comes together to meet our mission statement of making games that are more meaningful than real life. And that's kind of a very provocative statement. We're not saying like We think that playing video games is better than hanging out with your family or, you know, having children or, you know, graduating from college or anything like that. But we like to create games that elicit this sort of greater camaraderie, like people enjoy when they're playing for championship sports, you know, sports championships.
It's a team.
It's like a team thing. So
at one point, 500,000 people could at some point in time all be on the game at the same time on the same server?
In
theory, because I'm thinking that we should get some of these folks that are developing for you into Washington, because there's some need for a website up there that's having some difficulties right at this moment.
That's true.
And we can't get five people on it to get it to work correctly. So yeah. 500,000 would be a hoot.
Yeah, having gone through the technological hurdles over the years, kind of understand that, you know, to agree. But yeah, it's an interesting problem that, you know, will only need to be further solved by technology going forward. And we've reinvested a considerable amount of money into our servers and stuff like that to make sure that. Usually our max, I think, is around 63,000 people all at the same time. But even that's a really tough thing to do.
So what's the premise of the game?
That's a good question. So a lot of people ask that, kind of like, what's the point? And that's another reason why it kind of differs from a lot of other games. There's not really a point to the game.
Seinfeld show.
Yeah, it's kind of like a Seinfeld
show. Yeah, it is. It's a slice of life.
Well, you create your own purpose, really, in the game.
Yeah, you create your own purpose. And that's... because that's so different from other people's game experience, they're used to like saying, oh, what should I do next? I'll go kill this bad guy. Or, you know, you need to go build this thing. Like, you set your own goals in the game as a sandbox game. Like, what type of castle do you want to build? And so the point is kind of that. And also to have fun. I mean, it's a game.
Yeah, so. What's interesting, early on in the stages of the game, the players that were in it needed a way to organize. And what I always find entertaining is that the way they decided to organize is by forming corporations. It makes this corporate lawyer just so happy. but they literally would form corporations to sort of create their team, and then you'll have a leader, the corporate leaders of that, and then they'll group together with other players. And so a lot of time is spent recruiting players into your corporation, into your group, so that then you can have sort of combined goals and missions and things that you work toward.
Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about the how did you come up with the name Eve? I'm a fairly often reader of I guess the world's greatest selling book in history, and kind of begins with a young lady by the name of Eve. Does that have anything to do with your game, or is that just a coincidence?
Yeah, I think it sort of has to do with the game. Just a quick backstory into the game lore. Basically, humanity gets to a point where they discover a wormhole just in space, and they decide to send people through to a new area of space, and they're not really sure what it is. So they call it New Eden, being one of the best literary references you could have. And they exist there. The wormhole closes behind them, and then humanity takes its course again. So
we have our second Adam and Eve.
Yeah, they sort of schism out. You know, based on human nature, they have dark ages, they have renaissances, and then they discover the technology that allows the new type of pilots to fly spaceships, which are the players. They're sort of these immortal beings where when their ship is destroyed, then they have a copy of their entire mind, memory, personality sent to a cloned copy of themselves in the station. So that's kind of like the backdrop of the lore of the story, and that's where the name came from. We have a lot of expansions that are named after biblical references, mostly because they're such powerful references for naming something. I mean, they mean something to people. Yeah. So when you say Revelations, or you say Exodus, or you say Apocrypha, I mean, those are all names of our expansions. And, at first encounter, a lot of people are like, EVE Online, that must be a Bible game online. And it's not, but we do get the benefits of just the richness of literary reference that goes into it.
Whether anyone has any interest in the spiritual aspect of the world's greatest book, it's still, as you said, a powerful list of names and descriptions and events, et cetera, et cetera. Tell me a little bit about the demographics of the players. Are they all 17-year-old kids living with their mom, or But there's some 19-year-olds too.
To me, that's one of the fascinating things about EVE. The demographic tends to be older than the average game player. You know, if your average game player is sort of the 17 to 34 age range, ours tends to be on the higher end of that. You know, you may get, I mean, certainly we get some lots of kids playing the game, but you may see a lot of 45-year-olds playing this game. The other thing that's fascinating to me is there's a large percentage of our players that have postgraduate education. We have a lot of doctors, a lot of lawyers, a lot of engineers that love this game. And it's fun. I've heard more than a few people refer to the game as spreadsheets in space.
It's true, though.
It is, because there's so many windows and so many sources of information that you can have open at one time. It really does feel like, you know, information overload, and you've got to be able to handle all that and process it. But it's fun. Now, the flip side of that is you've got a very educated customer base, and so they understand what's going on, and they're frequent to point out things that they don't like or disagree with, and we like that. I mean, that's a great way for us to interact with the player base and challenge us, and also make sure the game is still fun.
Yeah, a couple other demographic things too. It's about 95% male, so it's a pretty interesting environment for a kind of woman to come into and play, because there's a lot of voice chat and stuff like that, and that creates a pretty interesting dynamic. And some of the most amazing sort of female gamers that I know play the game, and they're I won't say the word because it's I don't know what the rules are for radio, but they're amazing, like really super tough.
The Sisters of EVE.
Yeah, they're super tough, and they just play people like a fiddle, both in terms of actual combat and the social stuff.
But like women in real life. I didn't say that out loud, did I, Kevin?
No, not at all. I can edit that out.
Cut that part. Edit that out.
But in terms of the you know, the overall demographic, we have players from all around the world. Most the largest percentage are from the U.S., about 40%. But then we have 10% from the U.K., Germany, Russia, and then just spread out to other countries. And it's a really interesting thing, too, because initially when people come in, usually they'll seek out their own real world like group to play with. So all the Russians kind of stick together, or, you know, Italians or whatever kind of stick together. But then they realize like how advantageous it is for them to spread with people around the globe, because the game is running 24/7. And so they can provide like a much needed boost during a time zone where other people like might need their help to go move stuff around or attack their enemy.
Although, sorry, but there's a fascinating speech that our CEO gives from time to time. It's a bit of study in sociology, but you see patterns evolve among the players that are very similar to real life. So the Russians tend to play together, and they tend to be fairly aggressive and attack other people, and they may attack the Brits, and then the U.S. group will not want to attack the Russians directly, but they'll help supply the U.K. teams, you know, and you can just watch this whole cycle evolve among
real
the
world.
Countries.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, talk about the economy, too, because it's an interesting economy concept in EVE Online also.
Yeah.
The economy is my absolute favorite part of the game. So within the economy, you know, play the game, you need resources to do different things, and so you need to mine minerals, and you need materials to build your ships, and you also need money to buy things, and so there's a full trading economy that has developed. We use a virtual currency, which we call ISK, I-S-K, small footnote, that is also the same abbreviation for the Icelandic kroner. But we use ISK in the game and trade that to build your supplies, buy your supplies, and do your things. But what we found is that a number of players actually prefer to play the game like they're day traders. And many players would try to manipulate the markets and influence the price of the ISK and other things in the game, to the point where we ended up hiring a full-time economist just to manage the game currency. And in fact, we now have a research team that is behind him. We lured him away from a very prestigious professor role at one of the Iceland's universities. And he basically acts like our, you know, Ben Bernanke.
Yeah, I mean, and for him, it was kind of a no-brainer. It's kind of an abstract concept to think about at first, but, you know, those guys are always looking for a specific environment to model, like, economics in. And this is the one with, like, one of the most, like, complete information, you know, using real-world people to do it. You know, it's not just a computer simulation. I mean, these are real people acting on real economic principles based off of their own, you know, desires and I guess, adventures. It's been interesting for him, and he loves it.
What about problems with fantasism? Have you seen situations that have gotten out of hand with players that just became so obsessed that they were the game and created problems for other people? I know there have been some stories about Ponzi schemes created and folks actually figuring a way to monetize some of the trades back and forth. But kind of a little bit about how that's going for you.
Sure.
Let me just answer that by we love fanaticism.
Yeah.
I mean, we embrace it. You know, it's the best part. Just like any other entertainment group, you know, whether it's Rockstar or anything, you want people to enjoy it so much that they just love to be part of it and play.
Yeah, I mean, there is like a portion which would be considered unhealthy, but that's just like fans of any other game. I mean, for us, fanaticism is kind of encouraged by the game itself, because in this game, because it's this open world thing and you're determining your own goals and you're interacting with other people, and that's kind of the point of the game, your own character, like you as a person, whatever you're good at, translated into the game and doing that thing in the game, whether you're like a graphic artist and you create little graphic art stuff for your alliance or corp, or whether you're a radio personality and you want to do an Eve radio show. Like once you do that in game, then your character becomes your personality, becomes your character in this sort of cycle. And that kind of makes you to a fanatic in a way. And then you start getting invested in it, and it becomes another social outlet for you. You know, these guys become your friends. Over time. And
one of the ways that we embrace it, you know, and this is our lifeblood. Our players are our lifeblood. And so what we do every year is we have an annual fan festival, which is held in Reykjavik. And we will get anywhere between 1,500, 2,000 fans that will actually fly to Reykjavik just to be together for a long weekend, and meet their you know, their alliance members, their corp members, and actually meet them in person and plan and do everything that that you do in real life. It's funny, we had last year at FanFest with two players that met in the game, a guy and a girl that met in the game, and they decided to get married. And so we held the wedding at FanFest, and our CEO presided over the wedding. We had to get a special license in Iceland for him to be able to do that and make it legal. You know, those are all ways that we encourage a little bit of fanaticism.
Yeah.
A wedding with two people that meet online, playing the game, and then your CEO does the services.
Yep.
That's amazing.
I'm not going to say that's fanaticism. I'm going to say it's nuts. But it sounds like a good kind of nuts.
You run into some really fascinating situations. I mean, we get into some odd legal situations because a couple of my favorites. So if you'll indulge me, we get a request by a player who wanted to change his family crest, his family sigil, to the Galente symbol in the game. And you're kind of scratching your head going, okay, do I give this guy a license? Does he need to pay me a royalty? I mean, well, you know, how do you deal with these things? You know, it's a bit crazy. We had one player call in. He literally an hour before had found out that his wife was having twins, and he wanted to name the twins after ships in the game and wanted to know if that would be okay. I'm like, yeah, but you better check with your wife first. You know, it's amazing the crazy things that we do get. Yeah. From our fans. You might tell them about The Rock.
Oh, yeah. So there's one guy who was, he loved the game. He did a lot of writing around the game and really invested in the Twitter community and social media stuff. And actually, he's a really amazing guy for a lot of reasons. But he started taking on this persona, this character, just not like really, but that was kind of his social media thing. He would always answer tweets under this thing. He'd have this, like, you know, rule set of Rock's rule number 34, you know, like I don't know, eat 20 eggs before you get up, or, you know, something like that. But it was like this this kind of like really tough military colonel character. But the guy himself, like, he was a nice guy. He was maybe a little tough, but he kind of like reached a point where he'd been doing this a long time, and he realized, like, you know, I could myself like be a little bit tougher, be a little bit better, live a little bit like healthier. And so he went on this massive like game kind of inspired health kick, and like totally buffed up, and then came to FanFest 1 year like completely transformed, and he had like his head painted like his character, and like it was a really cool, really cool thing.
Inspiring, yeah. This guy went from a sort of an unhealthy lifestyle to a very healthy lifestyle to mimic his character in the game.
Yeah. That's amazing. Let's talk a little bit about the operational side of running a video game. I guess the business model for EVE Online is basically software as a service. And how does a video game company apply this common B2B business method in your day-to-day activities?
Yeah, we're definitely software as a service. You know, it's a very simple business model. You pay a fee for the month, and you get to play as much as you want for that month. I mean, it's, you know, we long predate the Netflix and the other groups that do this on a retail basis. So we sort of lucked into that largely, but it's worked quite well. It also puts a lot of pressure on us to make sure that we're delivering value and excitement, because players aren't going to give us their $15 each month if there's not something interesting to do. So we give a couple of major updates to the game every year, usually two major and between
a ton of minor ones,
four and six minor, so that there's always something new to see and do. It's been a great model for us. So it's different sometimes applying it in a, you know, direct retail setting rather than B2B, which is more common for a SaaS model. It's a bit more challenging because your customer base is 500,000 small payments, but you make it work.
Well, with a direct retail distribution model as you have, how do you ensure that your players and gamers are happy on a consistent basis? Is it the updates, the upgrades, or special contest, or what do you do to keep them engaged?
Man, that's we do a lot of stuff, and I won't say we're always successful over the EVE players that are out there, but yeah, it's a lot of things. I think the constant updates is something they really enjoy. You know, it'll be everything from adding new features like adding wormholes to space, to other stuff that's like more user interface focused or quality of life focused. We try to make a good mix of each so that people know that we're kind of working on the structure of the game and you know, doing our eating our vegetables, but then occasionally we'll serve them a nice steak, every so often. So that's one aspect of it, is actually creating content, make sure the game is fresh, updating the graphics, reinvesting in server technology, and that sort of stuff. We also do a whole host of other things, though. And a lot of this kind of comes down to communication and supporting the outside of the game sandbox. Bill mentioned earlier FanFest. That's a huge thing that we do. We've also started doing streaming as well. And we do a lot of social media interaction with them, forum interaction, all the sort of like customer service sort of oriented communication. But we also
Sorry to interrupt, but I mean, we've got a very traditional, you know, sort of customer service avenue. We call them game masters, right? Mm-hmm. So if you have a problem in the game, you think somebody's being unfair or something's not working on the technical side, you can send in, it's as simple as sending in an email, and we try to get you a response within 24 hours generally. Not always, there's some cases, but by doing that and staying very well connected to the customers, we feel like we do a pretty good job of keeping them happy.
Yeah, and there's a couple other things too. That was a very good point. We also, in addition to FanFest, we also sort of help host player gatherings. So we've been doing that around the world a lot more frequently in the past couple of years. I just got back from one that started in Vegas 2 years ago as a fan-based one where they just got a lot of people together and like rented a room in a hotel and hung out, to now, you know, it was big enough as like 350 people. And so we sent a bunch of people there. We had a big party. We revealed stuff on live stream about the upcoming expansion and all that sort of stuff. So supporting the players getting together outside of the game too is another strategy that we have, because everybody plays in the same game world. anything we can do to create more adhesion to the social structure of the game makes it less likely for people to quit, makes them have more fun when they're in the game, you know, gives them those stories from the history of EVE that makes it makes them feel like they've invested time in the game. So, I think there's probably about a dozen other things that we do.
You know, we should mention the CSM. Like so we have the Council of Stellar Management. It is essentially a player-elected council. And the benefit of being on this council is that we, CCP, will fly them to Reykjavik twice a year, and we'll sit down and say, you know, these are things we're working on. What do you think? Do you like them? Would you change anything? Do you have any ideas for us that you'd like to see in the game? And so they, it's not fair to call them a focus group, but they act in many respects like a focus group. But they're also a fantastic liaison to the players. And that's earlier when we were talking about elections. It was, you know, the players participate in the elections of the Council of Stellar Management, the CSM. So you've got to be fairly good at getting large groups to get behind you and agree to support you. So it's fun to watch that evolve, but it's also a great tool for us to make sure we're connected to the players.
That's one of my favorite times of year, actually, is the CSM election time, because they come up with these amazing bits of propaganda, video, and otherwise. And they all, they, like you're saying, they do it for many different reasons. You know, some of them use their in-game power to get elected. Like you would imagine a well-connected like mob boss. You know, that's like, okay, you're voting for me or else you're out. But other ones, you know, vote on more ideological reasons. Some get elected because of their reputation in-game. So it's really interesting to see, you know, we talked about economic simulator earlier, that EVE really can act as that. But it's also kind of a political simulator as well when it comes down to that.
Yeah, if you take a step back and think about it from a business point of view, if you try to think like of other technology companies in Atlanta, who, you know, how comfortable would they be saying, okay, all my customers can get a room, pick a couple guys, and then they can come and talk to us and tell us what they think they need to do, we need to do, you know, as a company. Managing that model is a challenge. But at the same time, it's a blessing because, you know, a lot of things that we can test out on them and they say, yeah, no.
Yeah, and no. they're right a lot of the time, too. And it's interesting, too. Like, you know, we say, like, it's a benefit for them to be able to come to ISO, but when they do, it's through a 3 or 4 day summit where they're 16-hour days sometimes discussing our game. And the actual sessions themselves are about an hour long with different parts of the company. And they're, you know, they were professionally moderated at the beginning, but by a guy that I think at the UN, and he, after the first session was over, he was like, wow, these guys were more prepared for this summit than anybody pretty much I've ever seen like in my actual job, you know. So it's a serious business, as we like to say. And it's, I think the CSM, you know, once EVE reached a certain population size, it was really hard for us as a company to understand the experiences of the majority of players, right? So you have people that are willing to go on forums, people that are willing to give back to you on social media, but there's going to be a vast amount of people, when you're talking about 500,000 people, that are not really that comfortable, you know, getting out there and voicing their opinion about the direction of the game. But through a sort of democratically elected, like, tribal council, so to speak, their voices heard like a lot better, and the CSM does take that role very seriously. You know, some of them came in to be elected for various reasons, but you know, when they get together, they all do very much think that like it is our responsibility to make sure we're representing the kind of will of the people as best we can understand it. So
we talked a little bit about the business model. You're selling all-you-can-eat buffet once a month. And for mobile games, you often hear free-to-play or freemium or whatever. What are these models and what do they mean for your players, the way that you operate your business?
Sure. You want me to go into that?
Sure. That's fine.
Yeah. So just in general, free-to-play is a type of game where you can download the game and play for free without ever having to pay anything. Freemium is sort of a model where you can do that, but then you also pay a certain amount of money to get more benefits out of the game. So to speak. EVE is traditionally a subscription game, so pay $15 a month and get your subscription. But we added a thing recently called Plex, Pilot's License Extension, and that's essentially one player will buy a month of game time from us ahead of time, so in advance, and then they'll create an in-game item out of that. And then somebody else in-game will buy that month from them using in-game currency and then apply it to their account. So the player in-game who bought the Plex is essentially getting free to play because they don't have to spend real world money for it, so to speak. And so as long as they're good enough in-game, they have enough in-game currency, then they can just keep playing forever, assuming somebody else is willing to sell them this Plex. The person out of game might not have enough time to do what they want to in-game to accrue, you know, wealth in-game and be willing to spend, you know, $15 extra on their hobby. So they'll do that and sell it in-game and then get in-game currency, which they can buy ships or, you know, modules or whatever.
It's interesting because it's changing within the industry. You know, there's a lot of push right now with mobile games and tablet games and things like that to be free-to-play or some version of freemium. And that's certainly something that we keep in mind as we develop our other games. We have a free-to-play game on the PlayStation known as Dust 514. You know, many know that we are in development on a third game called World of Darkness, and that's, you know, we have to look at those business models as we develop our games and figure out what makes sense for us as a company, what can we manage, but also what's good for the players. So it's a challenge because it's not solid ground. It's, you know, sand, and it moves around quite a bit.
Yeah, and part of it is, you know, some, like you were saying, some people, like players, might get used to that as the industry as a whole, but some might not actually want that. They like the idea that they're paying $15 a month, and that's all they're ever going to have to pay, really, into the game, and they feel like they're investing into something, and they feel like because everybody's investing into it, you know, everybody's kind of in it together, whereas sometimes in free-to-play games, they feel like, oh, those guys are just the free players. They're not willing to spend money. Or on the other way, they're like, oh, those guys are just trying to, like, they'll pay as much money as they need to win, and we're not interested in pay to win ever.
Yeah, that's a key for us. We do not want to set up a model where someone with a ton of money could just come in and pay to win. Mm-hmm. You have to be invested in the game. You've got to spend some playtime to get value out of this.
Yeah, and just sort of along those lines, when we first introduced Plex into the game, people were thinking, wow, somebody could spend, I don't know, $100,000 to buy all this Plex and sell them in game and become super wealthy in game. And a guy actually did that. There was a guy, I don't know if how well I'm allowed to go into this, but there was a guy.
You have a lawyer here, you can get away with it.
There was a guy that made a lot of money as an aluminum tycoon, and he wanted to win this virtual war. So he, you know, he couldn't go the illegal route would not be good. He would just get kicked out of the game. So he bought a bunch of Plex. And use that to fund a mercenary army for him in game, and the moral of the story is he ended up losing, and so, you know, he had enough money to be okay with losing $100,000 on his hobby, but it sort of proved that, you know, you can get ahead in a game like Eve, you know, maybe personally a little bit, but you're always going to encounter other people that are going to be able to beat you up. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, it's amazing the mistakes players make. And if you'll indulge us a story, there was one that hit the news recently about the owner of a fairly valuable ship.
$9,000.
Yes. it was rare. There was only three, I believe, left in the game. And long story short, a guy that he thought was an ally was actually working for an enemy, and convinced this person to, you know, to head to a particular region in Eve. A mistake was made, and the owner of this very valuable ship ended up in the wrong area of space. And so the rest of his fleet that was protecting him was not there. So if you can, you know, visualize your Star Wars movies and all those things, you've got an Imperial cruiser with no TIE fighters to go with it. Everybody descended on this ship just so that they could blow it up and take it out of the game. Massive value to the ship. So it's amazing to watch the mistakes the fans.
And the guy that was a spy, was he spent years of his life getting in that organization, moving his way up to one of the top spots too. So it's a lot of immersion.
There's you know, another story I love, and it's a bit of a sad story. It's a story about the Vile Rat.
I could tell if you want.
Yeah, you're actually better at telling it than I am.
Yeah, so there was a guy in game who was on the member of Council of Stellar Management, and his and he was probably elected that because he was so famous in game, and his way of playing was as a diplomat in game. He was involved in sort of spy organizations, but whenever like his major alliance would have you know, encounter a problem with another alliance, he would go in and work it out all the way from the top level down to the bottom level. He had his own like sort of corporation based off of that. He was one of the people that was killed in Benghazi. He was the sort of diplomatic kind of IT guy there. So mimicking, you know,
in real life.
Yeah, in real life. In real life. And so, you know, I don't know. It's such a tough thing to think about, honestly, even just years later, because, you know, he's an E player. And
yeah, and he was actually online in EVE at the time the attacks were occurring. And so some of his last words were through the game before. So it is, you know, it's amazing to us how far this game reaches and who it touches. You know, it's amazing. Mm-hmm. And it's nice, it's just a thrill to be a part of a product like that. It's rare, you know, in a B2B environment, you can get very excited and energetic about your products. But when you're going direct to the consumer and, you know, they are, like I said earlier, they're your lifeblood. And you know, you go to FanFest and you meet the people and you get to know them, good and life events can occur.
Yeah, and you know, and terrible tragedies like that affect the whole player base. We had a, you know, like everybody in game came and met at the same, you know, in one place, whether they're enemies or friends, and to pay tribute to them. So,
y'all have blown my mind. 40 minutes of our 45 minutes together, but I think there's more that I want to hear. So, what do you consider the next generation? And I can't even imagine or wrap my arms around that or my brain around it. But what does the next generation of gaming platforms look like? And where do we go from where you are now? Because you're basically living reality now in your games.
Virtual reality.
Virtual reality.
So excited about this. So we've been working on a little side project, which we call EVE Valkyrie. And it is a game that is built on three-dimensional virtual reality platform. And we've done stuff with Oculus Rift, and we've done things with other partners. But basically, it's like if you can imagine a headset that's about the size of your iPhone, and you wear it so that it covers your eyes, it blocks out the light. It's got a USB port that plugs right into your computer. And you can play a game that is so real that you're in the cockpit of a ship, and in order to see the enemies, you've got to look left, you've got to look right, you've got to look up, down. In fact, one of the biggest problems that we have with the game is about 5% of the people that play it get motion sickness.
Oh, no, they don't. They fixed that. And those guys were already hungover when they
Yeah, exactly. So, no, it's amazing. I just we just had the demo in our office last week, and I spent way too much time playing it. But it's fantastic because it's like a military simulator. You know, you've got all the information coming at you, all the ships, everything else. And this is something that's so simple, you just plug it into your PC. So the platforms are evolving. They're there. They will be hitting the market soon.
Yeah, and it's about that level of immersion we talked about earlier. That's the next level game. Even more immersion into the game world and your ability to affect it.
And affordable.
Yes.
What's the time frame on that?
It's going to be out next year. Next year.
What are the examples of a new product ideas for virtual worlds, sometimes more meaningful than life itself? And I think you've briefly described that already.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's doing that immersive thing, just in making sure that it's in the context of other people. So it's not just the experience of putting on the headset and flying around, which is amazing, but it's also doing it in a way where you, over time, you know, are still interacting with other people. You have that level of social meaning on top of the level of, like, experiential, encounter. So, you know, I think that's the best thing that could happen to the next level of gaming. So maybe that's like two steps down the road or something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I would describe it as the world of darkness.
Of course you would.
Game that we have under development in the Atlanta office here for CCP is the World of Darkness. As we mentioned before, this is based on intellectual property from the White Wolf acquisition, the merger. What a lot of people don't realize is that CCP owns a large trademark portfolio. It's one of the largest trademark portfolios on vampire marks and copyrights in the United States. And we are taking a lot of that intellectual property and looking at a game that revolves entirely around that. And, you know, when you mention vampires, it's just, it's something everybody knows. It's something that everybody loves. So we've got an office full of 100 people that only half of them think they are vampires.
That's true.
And talk about living a lifestyle. You know, it's a great way to embrace both a game, but also an experience that's as meaningful as life itself. It's just a phenomenal thing.
Yeah.
I think what we need on television is another vampire show.
we made one back in the 90s based off of our stuff. Us. I mean,
I've seen that.
Yeah, it's kind of horrible.
It's terrible. It's about to get re-released.
I know.
When it got the Abraham Lincoln vampire killer or whatever that was, I thought, man, maybe we've crossed the threshold.
The hidden history of the United States.
That's right.
Crazy. You know, there are a lot of successful entrepreneurs in our community, and we've had a lot of them on this show, and some that have been not so successful. Many times their technology and businesses have run the course very, very quickly. How has CCP stayed and survived this long, and what has allowed you to transform your business over the past 10 years into where you're going now?
We're Vikings.
Yeah, it's sort of that
Warriors.
It's sort of that spirit. It's it's having a vision, rowing towards the distance, you know, being okay for a little while, surviving on the scraps of I don't know that much about Viking culture.
Yeah, but there's that, and then also we have a keg in our company Cantina that's labeled the Enabler, and between the two of those, we managed to find a way to grow. Being serious, I mean, I think it's the attention of the customers. You know, all of our players, they love what we do. They give us feedback to what we do. And so we can ensure that we're headed in a direction that they want. So we owe a lot of it to the fans. Now, we also, I mean, we do a lot to make sure we have a good company environment. The Atlanta office is a fantastic example. I mean, we've got an interesting mix of engineers, traditional engineers, you know, guys who write code, guys who develop the structure of the game, and artists. You know, we have people who work on fashion design. We have people who work on art and architecture in the game. You know, and trying to blend those cultures can be a challenge sometimes. I also often describe myself as the left brain guy trapped in a right brain world. Making sure that we push ourselves and stay out of our comfort zone, I think, is key to growing.
Yeah. We've also, I mean, on the business side of things, we've reinvested a significant amount of profits back into the company, whether it's technological or hiring more people. Like in the case of Eve, there are more people working on Eve now, I think, than ever. It's a mix of all that stuff and willingness to have the vision for a game that could potentially last a long time and then kind of the courage to keep up with it and keep it going.
One last couple of questions. Atlanta is a great technology community, and many people would argue we are number 4 or 5, Silicon Valley, Austin, Boston, maybe Research Triangle, and then maybe Atlanta or Portland, then Atlanta. But we're not known for an entertainment area. I know Chris Kloss, after he sold his business to IBM, started a gaming company, if you will, and there have been a few others, but not to the degree of the success that you guys have had. Why are you in Atlanta? I know originally for the acquisition, but why have y'all chosen to stay here for the past 10 years or more?
You know, let me answer that one. Georgia as a state has done a phenomenal job of encouraging the entertainment industry to focus here. And it was, I think, maybe back in late 2007, early 2008, they actually started by doing a small tax credit for entertainment-based companies. And you're starting to see the fruits of that right now, because you see a lot of the big movie companies locating here. You know, if you go to the St. Regis in Buckhead, you're going to run into 3 or 4 movie stars, you know. They've done that on the movie side. They've done that on the music side. They've also done it on digital entertainment, video games, and other things. And so you're seeing we're right at the point where we're reaching a critical mass of all of those companies being based in Atlanta. So it is becoming a good solid hub. You've got a number of other video game companies here. You've got Thrust Interactive, you've got Games at Work, you've got Alan Wilson at Tripwire. There's a ton of great game companies, but there's also the movie studios and the production studios like Giant Studios that does motion capture and others that support it. So Georgia, you know, I give them a ton of praise for their efforts because they've really built that community for us. And it has created the reason for us to stay and grow and expand.
That's exciting. As an Atlanta native, I'm always excited to hear about great things going on in a community and in Atlanta and the state of Georgia as well. I find this very hard to believe, but 54 minutes have gone by since we started, and I'm on question number 10 or 11 of the 20 that I wanted to grill you guys with. So I'm going to take a point of personal privilege and invite you guys back when your time allows, next maybe 3 or 4 or 5 weeks or whatever, and because it's so fascinating, and I think that I now have even more questions I'd like to ask when we get together next time. But in closing, if you would each maybe once again give us the web address, but more importantly, your personal information. If someone listened to something they heard today or download later and would like to contact you personally, whether that be on LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, whatever, or your personal email, each of you share that, and then I'll close the show and we'll call it a wrap. But start with Ned, I guess.
Yeah, sure. Again, my name is Ned Coker, and you can reach me at Twitter at CCP_manifest. That's my my secret CCP identity name. And a website where you can find out more stuff about CCP and its products is www.ccpgames.com.
That's right. And I'm Bill Winter, and you can find me on LinkedIn, or you can use my CCP address, which is bwinter@ccpgames.com.
And, of course, Jess Jones is here with us today, and you can follow Jess's Twitter feed at JJESSJJONES. And I thank Jess for being here and sharing the information. But I have to say, Bill and Ned, I learned a ton today, and I really appreciate you guys' time and energy and what you're doing and making our community more exciting. And I wish you well, and I look forward to trying some of the games a little bit more diligently over the next couple of weeks, because I'm fascinated now. I don't know that I'm going to become a fan or get married on one of the boards or one of the worlds, but I'm at least going to dig into it a lot more after today.
Yeah, let me know. You can come fly with me anytime.
All right, that'll be a lot of fun. Well, again, thank you. It has been a great program, and this is Ricky Steele, and I finished my coffee in Booth 61. I hope you'll come back and join me for a fresh cup next Wednesday or by listening to any past shows anytime at Booth 61 with Ricky Steele. This show should be up by Friday at the latest. I try to always close our time together by sharing a blessing, hopefully for you, your family, and perhaps your business. The blessing comes from the Book of Numbers. We were talking about the Bible a little earlier today. May the Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face to shine upon you and be gracious to you. May the Lord turn his face towards you and give you peace. Amen. Thank you for dropping by, and join us again next week for a fresh cup in Booth 61.